This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne. Today marks 60 years since the start of the first American offensive of the Second World War, the Battle of Guadalcanal. On this date in 1942, thousands of U.S. Marines splashed ashore on the then obscure island in the Southwest Pacific and dug in for 6 months of desperate struggle against not only the Japanese, but against heat, jungle rain, disease, and hunger. Before Guadalcanal, the Japanese initiated every move in the Pacific War. Afterwards, the United States and its allies decided where and when to fight. In the second of our two-part National Geographic radio expedition, NPR's Neil Conan reports from Guadalcanal.
It was all about the airfield. These days, Henderson International Airport is the home of Solomon Air and its tiny fleet of small island hoppers. Jets from Fiji and to Australia stop by a couple of times a week. This island is so remote, it's hard to imagine why anyone wanted it badly enough to fight for it. But if you look at a map of the Southwest Pacific and think about how far planes could fly in 1942, you can see it. From here, Japanese aircraft could threaten Australia's supply lines to the United States. The Japanese started this airfield in May 1942. It was almost finished when the Marines took it away from them. They completed construction and quickly added an auxiliary strip nearby called Fighter One. Marine pilot Jeff DeBlanc remembers choking dust when it was dry and mud when it wasn't.
When it was raining, it was an awful thing. You had a slippery outfit and you slid with the wheels almost locked for at least 10 feet before you could get traction and enough power to get you off the deck and to clear the coconut trees at the end of the runway.
8 months into the war, it was really hard for both sides to fight so far away from their bases, but both came to believe that this battle would be decisive. The two sides were more or less even militarily. Both could land troops on Guadalcanal, but both struggled to provide them with the food and the bullets and the bombs that they would need to win. Historian Richard Frank describes Guadalcanal as a mutual siege where control of the waters around this island changed every 12 hours.
By day, the U.S., thanks to the ability of American flyers to operate out of Henderson Field, made it possible for American supplies to be brought in. But at night, the Japanese ruled, and they used that period to bring in their troops and their supplies.
Conditions for both sides were terrible. Jeff DeBlanc recalls stumbling out of his pup tent almost every night when a lone Japanese bomber would arrive overhead. The Marines called him Washing Machine Charlie because his engines were deliberately desynchronized to keep them awake. He also remembered that the food was awful.
Sometimes they would give us beans. Now, you don't eat beans and go up to 30,000 feet in an unpressurized cabin. It's pretty hectic.
DeBlanc and the other Marine fighter pilots flew the F-4F Wildcat, a sturdy little plane that had trouble keeping up with the famous Japanese Zero. But the Americans had a secret advantage, the Coast Watchers. This was a network of mostly Australian men who stayed behind when the Japanese invaded the Solomons, moved up into the hills, and sent warnings of incoming air raids by radio.
That gave us enough time, at least 40 minutes, to scramble out of Fighter One and meet the Japanese 60 miles away from Guadalcanal. And that's why we would shoot most of the bombers down and have our dogfights with the Zeros before they hit Henderson Field.
But some of those bombers got through. Frank Godone was a sergeant in the Marine Raider Battalion on Guadalcanal who learned that Japanese air raids arrived just about every day around noon.
If you expected to come over, and there you go, we run into our foxhole, and most of us laid on our back, and we could see the big Vs, you know, the bombers coming over there, and it's just a matter of waiting. You could get killed in a couple ways. One of their bombs could go off in the coconut trees ahead of you and drown you with shrapnel, or it could come down and make an impact and just wipe you out totally. It was just a matter of luck. That was it.
The most dangerous Japanese attack came over land, out of the jungle, in mid-September. Somehow, Major General Kiyotaki Kawaguchi maneuvered about 3,000 soldiers across rivers and ravines to what he hoped was the undefended side of the American perimeter. All that stood between him and Henderson Field was a bald coral ridge held by about 850 Marines from the Raider and Parachute Battalions under the command of the charismatic Colonel Merritt Edson. Brave and determined Japanese soldiers charged up the steep slopes of the ridge through withering fire. Historian Richard Frank says they pushed the Marines back to within a few yards of Edson's command post.
He was the heart and soul of the defense that night, rallying and directing and calling in fire support that enabled the Marines to hold the ridge. It's one of those instances where you can truly say that one individual made the difference in how things came out.
Bloody Ridge, as it came to be known, was one of 20 land battles on Guadalcanal. There were a dozen naval battles as well, and the Wildcats and Zeros fought in the air almost every day. In the end, Richard Frank says it came down to food. The Marines didn't eat well or often, but they ate. The Japanese did not.
The problem for the Japanese was that they were restricted primarily to running resupply to Guadalcanal on destroyers. They could relatively easily haul in troops, so they kept dumping more and more mouths on Guadalcanal and not enough food. It's no wonder the Japanese came to call it Starvation Island.
In late January 1943, the Japanese sent one final convoy to Guadalcanal to evacuate their emaciated troops. Jeff DeBlanc shot down 5 Japanese airplanes covering that convoy and won the Congressional Medal of Honor for it. But by that time, the Marines and the Army troops that relieved them had already eliminated a lot of Japanese positions. One of those outposts was up on Mount Austin, where the Japanese had a perfect view of Henderson Field and all the American positions below. I drove up there with John Innes, a British-born Australian who runs a computer company on Guadalcanal. He's become the local expert on the battle. As bad as this road is, it wasn't there in 1943. The Japanese called Mount Austin the Gifu, named after the part of Japan where most of the soldiers came from. They were surprised by the American attack, but fought very stubbornly.
This is the water hole that the Japanese were using to get the water to the Gifu area. I have heard stories that they allowed the Americans to get the water from here and the Americans allowed them to get the water from here, but I don't know if it was that gentlemanly.
John Innes led me up a steep, narrow path to a small clearing. After we pushed the tall grass out of the way, he showed me a white memorial stone. It marks the spot where the last Japanese on Mount Austin found what was by their lights an honorable death in a final bonsai charge.
They were out of ammunition, out of water, absolutely no hope, no food. They considered all of their options and they said, "We can't leave the dead."
As we were leaving the battlefield area, the Gifu, one of the kids who live here, came up and handed John what looked like to me a couple of large clumps of coral. Bones, John said. Probably Japanese. We left them in the offering bowl at the base of the Japanese memorial to be burned the next time the relatives come here. For Radio Expeditions, I'm Neil Conan, National Public Radio, on Guadalcanal.
Veterans from both sides are gathered on Guadalcanal to commemorate the anniversary and revisit the battlefields where they fought 60 years ago. Radio Expeditions is a co-production of NPR News and the National Geographic Society. Maps and pictures are on our website, npr.org.